Christmas time. Because you have a Christmas Day service at a sensible time, whereas Myton is extraordinarily early for a man living on his own with no children to get him up. But anyway, I feel I'm among friends because so many of you I've known for a good few years now. Well, while you're turning to Daniel chapter 7, I want you to imagine that you're being persecuted. A foreign king has tried to stop your religion completely and suppress it totally. And anybody who wanted to carry on with that religion is likely to die. And you're reading your religious book, and you realize that you're reading the history of the last 150 years that have just happened, and that they were prophesied 200 years before that. Because that's the sort of impact that our passage tonight would have had on a particular group of Jews in the 2nd century BC. And I hope I'll persuade you that it's not just that particular group who'll find it relevant, but us too. It's a long passage, so what I'm planning to do is to read some, summarise the rest, and put in comments as I go, and then at the end I'll just make a few points of application, trying to bring it into the 21st century. So, starting with chapter 10 and verse 1. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message came to him in a vision. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. Two things to remember. Note the 3 weeks. And it also suggests that although it doesn't say he was praying, it was so characteristic of Daniel, and there are other things later that make me think that this was the background to his prayer and the way he was praying. So picking it up again in verse 4. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris, I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, with a belt of the finest gold around his waist. His body was like chrysolite, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. Now, if that sounds familiar, it should be, because the same sort of imagery is used in both Ezekiel and in Revelation, and I think in quite a lot of the hymns and songs that we sing these days. So that was a vision. Verse 7. I, Daniel, was the only one who saw the vision. The men with me did not see it, but such terror overwhelmed them that they fled and hid themselves. So I was left alone, gazing at this great vision. I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. Then I heard him speaking, and as I listened to him, I fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. A hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said, Daniel, you who are highly esteemed, consider carefully the words I'm about to speak to you and stand up, for I have now been sent to you. And when he said this to me, I stood up trembling. Now, in that little section, notice a couple of things. The impact of the vision left Daniel trembling and unable to stand. But the man, an angel, God, Daniel doesn't tell us, reassures and supports Daniel. Now, seeing what God is like, appreciating him, should have that sort of impact on us. But God never intends just to knock us down. That would actually be very easy for him. He does the hard thing, which is to communicate and establish a relationship. But that said, there's probably too little awe among us these days. So, he's not knocking us out, but that should be our response. Then, taking it up in verse 12, then he continued, do not be afraid, Daniel. Since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns a time yet to come. Notice the 21 days matching the 3 weeks that I pointed out earlier. So God's response to Daniel was actually immediate. Daniel didn't know it, but it was. And I think that's something we can take encouragement from. But in this section, I want to dwell briefly on verse 13. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now that raises a lot of issues because it seems strange to us. But Daniel actually took it in his stride. You notice first that he was absolutely shattered, but it was shattered by the vision, not by this. And secondly, the idea of angels with responsibilities for nations would actually have been familiar to him. To us it seems strange, but it would have been a very commonplace thing for him and his fellows in those days. Because in the ancient Near East, each nation had its own god or gods that would fight with other gods on their behalf. And so that was the pattern that was expected. Now, for Israel, it couldn't be quite like that, because for them, there was only one God. And he had kept Israel for himself. And so all the other gods of the nations actually became angels. And so they were demoted, so to speak. So Israel had the God, and all the other nations had angels. So that would have been familiar to Daniel. And you can see this as an example in Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9. It's worth turning to, leaving a finger or thumb in Daniel, because I want, for those of you for NIVs, with NIVs, to point to the margin as well. Deuteronomy 32, verse 8. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, he set up boundaries for the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob his allotted inheritance. If you notice, there's a footnote for the sons of Israel suggesting that it might be the sons of God. I think there's good reason to think that that's probably the original that was written. So the sons of God is a common term used in the Old Testament for angels. So what Deuteronomy is telling us is that for the nations, they had assigned angels. But the Most High kept Israel for himself. So I wanted to show that as familiar, something that was not strange and foreign and new to Daniel. Because it didn't affect the way he prayed. 2 weeks ago, Andy was talking about chapter 9. And I don't think any of that sort of concept ever appeared there. It was something that Daniel had as familiar. It was background understanding of the way things were. But his prayer in chapter 9 focused on God. It was directed to God himself. It focused on him. And it consisted of confession and supplication for the nation. So this, in verse 13, where you get the princes fighting against one another, was not new revelation teaching Daniel how to pray. He already knew about it. And so he wasn't praying that way. Because and chapter 9 is still a valid model for us to pray. As I hope Andy showed. I guess you made that point a couple of weeks ago, Andy. Good. Okay, so I felt I wanted to dwell on that just a little bit, because it's one of the things in the passage that's very strange to us, and I wanted to show that it probably wasn't to Daniel. Okay, picking up the reading again at verse 15. While he was saying this to me, I bowed with my face toward the ground and was speechless. Then one who looked like a man touched my lips and opened my mouth and began to speak. I opened my mouth and I began to speak. I said to the one standing before me, I am overcome with anguish because of the vision, my lord, and I am helpless. How can I, your servant, talk with you, my lord? My strength is gone and I can hardly breathe. Again, the one who looked like a man touched me and gave me strength. Do not be afraid, O man highly esteemed, he said. Peace, be strong now, be strong. When he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, speak, my lord, since you have given me strength. So he said, Do you know why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince, and in the first year of Darius the Mede I took my stand to support and protect him. So there again, the man is encouraging, he's strengthening Daniel to enable him to recover from the awesome vision that he had received. Now, taking it up again at verse 2. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdoms of Greece. Then a mighty king will appear, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parcelled out towards the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. Now, you've already met in the earlier parts of Daniel the four world empires that appear from time to time throughout the book: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And these three verses actually cover much of that very, very briefly and quickly. So in verse 2, you have Persia. In verse 3, Alexander the Great, now famed in television and the movies. And in verse 4, the four successors of Alexander when his empire was divided up after his death. But this very brief run through the long part of the history sets up the stage for two of Alexander's successors, the kings of the north and the kings of the south. And they were the ones who had the most impact on Israel, which was sandwiched between them, between Egypt and Syria. What's changed? But that's being set up in this passage. Now, the next section I shall just summarize, and in verses 5 to 20, we have the struggle back and forth between the Ptolemies in Egypt in the south and the Seleucids in Syria in the north. And, well, you could compare that with a textbook of ancient history, point by point, and you say, look, one, the other, one, the other. All there. And all the details are there. But it actually reads almost like a textbook of ancient history. So what's it doing in the Bible? Why do we need to know this? I'll give you three reasons for having this sort of thing in the passage at all. Firstly, it gives us God's take on history. History interpreted from God's point of view. We get something of an idea of the way he views what goes on in the world. And we can sometimes transfer that a bit to the way he sees what goes on in the world today. For instance, in verse 21, one of the kings is described as a contemptible person, someone to be despised. And that's telling us what God thinks of that particular king and any kings like him. So we've got God's take on history is one of the reasons for something like this. Another thing is perhaps less so in this chapter and more in chapters 7 and 8, where you have the beasts and a lot of imagery. The imagery actually conveys more than just their identity. If you say, this beast is this king, or this horn is this king, they actually missed the most important point of the imagery. It's the bestial imagery is telling us something about the character of the kings and the empires that they represent. That these empires and kings are bestial, subhuman, aggressive, destructive. And so just identifying who they are is not enough. What is it telling us about them? And again, it's giving us God's perspective. And the other thing is, as I suggested in my introduction, that there would be a time when people would look back and realize, wow, this is the last 150 years, prophesied long beforehand. And that would mean that they would then look at the bits that haven't been fulfilled, that were prophesied but are yet still future, and say, okay, that's, I believe, that could happen. So by the fulfilled prophecy, encourages people to believe that which not yet has been fulfilled. Now, moving on to the next section, verses 21 to 27. In fact, all the way on to verse 35, at least as far as 35. We're now focusing on one particular king. He was a king of the north, a contemptible person, known to historians as Antiochus Epiphanes. And I've heard it pronounced Antiochus and Antiochus, and I would probably oscillate between them because I'm not quite sure which is right. He reigned from about BC 175 to 164, about 400 years after Daniel's time. So that was the start of the king of the north, a contemptible chap, but I'll pick up the reading at verse 28. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. In other words, the covenant between Yahweh God and Israel. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice, the sacrifice that took place in the temple every morning and evening. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. So what we have here is the contemptible person attacking the worship of God and all those who won't conform to his will, but want to remain faithful to their God. Now, so far, the prophecy matches in great detail what's known from other sources. But in verses 36 to 39, we start to see a shift. What we have there in those verses, I shan't read them, is all extremely general. It's about the king's religion. And there's nothing in there that either matches or disagrees with textbooks of ancient history. So it's starting to move from the very specific and the detail that matches history through something more general. And then we get to verses 40 to 45. We get what appears to deal with the end of a contemptible person. If you look at the end of verse 45, the second half, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. But none of verses 40 to 45 matches anything that's known about Antiochus Epiphanes from other sources. And that starts to make you think and say, okay, what's going on here? Well, and did the prophet just get it wrong? You may guess that I shan't be taking that route, though many do, of course. More plausible, perhaps, is it just a general affirmation that somehow or other the king's arrogance will be brought to an end? Maybe. I'd like to suggest that there's actually a shifting away from the specific of Antiochus Epiphanes himself to a more generalized evil empire, representing all human empires that will characterize the whole of the times, from Antiochus on to the end of the end, so to speak, that we find in chapter 12. And so we're getting from someone who is specific, who is actually typical of the sorts of evil empire that one gets throughout human history. And that's what's going on here. Well, you may not like that, and I'm not totally satisfied with it myself. I think it's the best I can do from a bit of thought and a fairly wide reading. So there we're getting on to, if you like, a shift from a specific to a general, and then on to the end itself. I'm taking it up in chapter 12 and verse 1. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress, such as not has happened from the beginning of the nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Now, in the Old Testament, the nature of life after death is very hazy indeed. We learn very, very little about it. And it is, one might say, is there much, is it, did they even think in those terms? And I'm not sure that there's really very much at all about life after death in the Old Testament. And whatever, this is the only reference to a double resurrection, to life or to shame and contempt in the Old Testament. So this is something new in God's progress of revelation. This is something he's opening up for the first time. It's all much clearer in the New Testament, but it seems to start here. And verse 4. But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on this bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. One of them said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled? The man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, lifted his right hand and his left hand towards heaven. And I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, it will be for a time, times, and half a time. When the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed. I heard, but I did not understand. Well, anyone else? So I asked, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? He replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of 1,335 days. As for you, go your way until the end. You will rest, and then at the end of days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. Now, as we try to see its relevance to us, I want to suggest that it's good to look at it through the eyes of the people I described, the people who are suffering the malice of Antiochus in the second century. And we find that there are many principles that applied to them that can be applied to us, and I hope that's what I can do in the remaining brief time at my disposal. Now, if you followed through the book, you will have seen the narrowing of focus right the way through it. In chapter 2, you had four empires covering over 800 years in a very, very generalized way. Chapter 7 gave you the same four empires portrayed by beasts with more detail. Chapter 8, you focus down to Medo-Persia and Greece, a ram, you remember the ram and the goat and the horns. In chapter 11, we've got the Greek Empire and the rivalries between the north and the south in lots and lots of detail. And finally, in the second half of the chapter, we focus down to one specific king. It's as if that was where the whole book was going. And that actually was the time of the greatest threat to God's people for over 400 years. So that focusing down to give a message to them. If we see it through the eyes of those caught up in Antiochus's malice, it may help us to see the thrust of the book. And the big question I think that the book is answering is, how do we respond when it all goes wrong? What resources does the Bible give us, and particularly this book, to respond and understand and think when things go wrong? For them, it was drastic. It was life and death. For us, it's often less so, but not always. Some of the similar principles apply. And I want to try to bring three answers, partial answers, from this book to how do we respond when it all goes wrong. Now, the first thing I think these people would have needed was reassurance that the suffering was not a result of their sin. That's perhaps less of a problem now, but I suspect that too often when things go wrong with us, we sometimes think, have I done something wrong? Is God getting at me? And that is very sad. And I think it's wrong, but it was wrong for them and it's wrong for us. Because they would have been aware that the exile, when all the Israelites, all of Judah, were transported from their own country to Babylon, was very much a punishment for sin, that God sent Nebuchadnezzar to conquer them and to send them into exile. And they would have realized that this was the reason Daniel was in Babylon, with all the prophecies and all the first half of the book. So it raised the expectation, or at least the question, that perhaps the malice of Antiochus was also punishment sent by God. But one of the things to notice from the middle of chapter 11 onwards is that it's the wise who are suffering persecution. Notice that verse 11:33, those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. And the wise come up several other times in the last chapter and a half. So this was innocent suffering. What was happening was that a particular evil king had a deep-seated malice against God and his people. So the world was attacking God, and his people got caught up in it. And I hope that for them, would have made them realize that any guilt feelings they might have were irrelevant. And for us too, that when things go wrong, it's not necessarily God getting at us, but rather it's part of the way things are in a fallen world and the way things are when there are evil people out there. Secondly, the discussion of resurrection at the beginning of chapter 12 in verses 2 and 3 that I'll read again. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. As I pointed out, that's very unusual for the Old Testament, but it does have relevance to the situation that the people were in and that we're in too. We can look at it in general terms and say that it shows that this is a moral universe, that God takes sin seriously and doesn't leave it unpunished. He will vindicate his people, and that is an encouragement to remain faithful. I think we can also look at it and apply it at a more personal level, because it shifts expectation. Because most of the Old Testament, they expected a reward for righteousness and punishment for sin in the present life before death. What this passage is doing is shifting that expectation, saying, okay, it won't necessarily work out okay in this life, but things will work out. There will be reward and punishment after death. And that's, of course, the theme that the New Testament takes up very much. Now, think back through the book. The stories of the fiery furnace and the lion's den make great Sunday school stories. But life isn't always like that. How would we preach that passage knowing that there were more Christian martyrs in the 20th century than in the previous 19? For many, it doesn't work out this way. And we need to realise that. But even in these stories of the lion's den and the fiery furnace, turn back to chapter 3 and verse 17, there's a recognition that it might not work this way. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego are replying to the king. Verse 17 of chapter 3. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. Here we go. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of God you have set up. So they're fully confident that God is able, but they recognize the possibility that he might not. But they still press on. So there's a shifting of expectation there. So here we have a promise, not of deliverance from death, Though we had two examples earlier in the book, here's the promise is of deliverance through death and the promise of afterwards. I do want to tell one story of a lady in my previous church. She was diagnosed with lung cancer. She'd been a heavy smoker all her life, and some years earlier she'd been converted quite dramatically and totally unmistakably, the sort of person you just know. But she still had the addiction problem, and eventually it caught up with her. And of course the church prayed for her, right and proper that we should. But there were some who, when she wasn't healed, started to tell her that it was her lack of faith. I thought that was cruel, adding to the knowledge that she was dying, guilt feelings about her lack of faith. So we were right to pray for her, but she was right too, because they didn't actually undermine her faith. Her faith was probably greater than theirs, because as she was dying, she was trusting the Lord and continued to trust him. And so, in a way, she was not delivered from death, but she was delivered through death. And I appreciated her. She was actually my cleaner, came in to clean for me once a week until she was too ill to do it. And the third way is a major theme in the book, is understanding. It comes up again and again and again. And mostly people look at the book of Daniel and say, I don't. And in our passage tonight, it's the wise make their first appearance, and they come up four times. But I think understanding is important. If we understand God's ways, and incidentally, if we want to give a fancy name to understanding God's ways, some people call it theology, but since some people think that's a dirty word, but understanding God's ways and applying it. So not as a detailed future history, and certainly not as a detailed analysis of everything that happens to us. And how many of us would express surprise that God let Nigel die earlier this year? Does God know what he's doing? Can we work? But yes, I'm glad to hear see a nod over there. But yes, of course he does. But we can't work it out. And that's not the sort of understanding that we should aim for. But there is an understanding that we should have from the general principles of Daniel and the rest of the Bible, applying them to the sorts of things that happen to us and in the world. And the first thing I'd say is that there are many time words in our passage and throughout. Time, times and half a time, 1290 days, 1335 days, and just the word time appears time and time again in Daniel. And if we use them to plot out a timetable, I think we've missed the point that the book is making. The point is that the suffering is not forever. There is a time. God has set a limit. Now, he knows what he meant by a time, time and half, time, times and half a time, even if we don't. Maybe Ian told you when he was preaching on chapter 7, but I doubt it. So that's one thing, a recognition that there is a limit. And the other, there are many little indicators of God's work in history. You actually have to go through and look hard. And if you read the book through quickly, you might miss them. But chapter 1 and verse 2, it was the Lord who delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't have agreed. He thought it was his magnificent army. But the scripture is telling us from God's perspective who did it, and it was God who delivered him. Chapter 2, you remember the stone that destroyed the world empires. It was the kingdom of God. Chapter 4, it was a messenger from heaven who decreed Nebuchadnezzar's downfall. Chapter 7, verse 26, referring to Antiochus, his power will be taken away. Notice, sorry for a bit of linguistics, but notice the passive voice of the verb there. It was taken away. Implication by God. Because that's so often the way that the Bible speaks of God's activity. 8:25, again Antiochus. He will be destroyed, but not by human power. So there is an encouragement to see in the ways, right the way through the book, of God at work in history. So good and evil are not equally ultimate. The final result is not in doubt. And now, very briefly, as a conclusion. It's interesting, I don't know if you picked it up, something that wasn't in our passage. There was no exhortation. Typically, a sermon might close with exhortation. Go out and do something. But that's not in our passage. If I'm right about who it was intended for, they needed encouragement. And they were getting on okay, and they were doing okay. So they needed encouragement. They didn't need exhortation. But there was an assumption about how God's people were behaving. And indeed they were at the time. But 11:32, I'm using the ESV for this one, because I actually think it avoids certain issues. The people who know their God will stand firm. So they were standing firm. And there are the wise that I've mentioned several times before. They instruct many, but they suffer. They stumble, but they're refined and made ready for the end. They will shine like the heavens. They will lead many to righteousness. And they will understand, not the details, but the outcome. And so they'll live in the world we have to live in as faithful, standing firm, and encouraging others. Let's be like them.